If your morning starts with snap, crackle, pop, and it's not your cereal, call Joint Relief Institute for fast-lasting joint pain relief. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. 708-888-0000.
This week, the Rascals mince about Britain trying to make Britain great again by exiting from the EU. They also discussed John Cullerton's big fail when he went to meet with constituents, and who's happy that Dee Rose has been traded from the Chicago Bulls.
Today is Friday. It's June 24th. Where did the summer go? 2016. I'm John Williams. We are the Mincing Rascals. You can listen to me on WGN Radio and part of this broadcast Saturdays at 1.
I'm Steve Bertrand, the host of the Business Lunch on WGN.
I'm Krista McQuarrie, a member of the Chicago Tribune editorial board.
I'm Eric Zorn, beloved columnist for the Tribune. I'm on Wednesdays, Fridays, and Sundays.
As we speak, the Brexit vote is just hours old. Great Britain has voted 52-48 to exit the European Union. David Cameron has said he's going to step down this fall. Markets across the globe are falling. British pounds taken to beating. The Dow opened today down 500 points. My question to you guys is, do you see any similarities between the UK vote and what's happening here right now? And what lessons can we learn from this? Eric, why don't you go first?
Absolutely, I see similarities. I see in the Leave vote an anti-immigrant, a working-class frustration with the way things are going, anti-foreigner, anti-immigrant, and I think that we can see that that's the sort of the kind of seeds that are growing in this country that have given rise to Donald Trump.
Rural as well, you know, outside the cities we're voting for the exit.
Right, and it's the people were saying, I was listening to some of the people interviewed, they voted with their heart. They were angry, they wanted to vote with their heart, but as they, I think there's going to be some real buyer's remorse or voter's remorse over this in the
UK. Why do you say that?
Because I think that they were promised that things were all going to be great. And people and these warnings about a market collapse were just a bunch of chicken littles. And you're seeing some real problems right away, and I think the problems are just going to continue. And
do they have Make Great Britain Great Again signs? Is that, or hats maybe that they were wearing over
I think
there?
There
was an element of that.
Definitely.
I mean, very much
don't
a
you think?
Nationalistic type theme. And I think there will be a lot of bumpy road ahead in terms of untangling them from the EU, but I think they knew that and they are willing to take those risks very similarly to what the Trump rise has been here, a willingness to take risk, to be very anti-establishment and to just, you know, rebel against your government.
But there's a difference now. Both countries were chattering about it. Now they're going to do it and they're going to have to come to terms with it and what it means. I mean, there's so many peripheral stories. You know, if you go to the south of Spain, right, it's almost a little England. Everyone retires down there. Those people, those thousands of people are probably going to have to move back to England, right? They're going to lose their EU insurance coverage, all of that. Scotland now says it will probably vote again for independence or to break away because 62% of Scots voted to stay in the EU. There are just all of these things that have to be resolved, and I think it'll be interesting to see if this went Trump's way, will it lead to votes going Trump's way in November, or will voters here say, wow, that was bigger than we thought?
I think you give voters too much credit for paying attention. And the other thing is that I feel like this vote underscores what a change year this is. And this is a big threat to Hillary Clinton, which is Hillary Clinton has, I think, considerable virtues as a presidential candidate, but being a candidate for change is not one of them. And the country, the world is just, they want change. They're frustrated with the way things are going, the way the economies are going all over the world in the United States. They want change. And they said, well, it's a chance. Nobody thinks, I don't think there's anybody out there who doesn't think that electing Donald Trump would be an enormous risk. But as Kristen said, this was a vote for risk, for taking this big chance.
I don't know. I don't think people have thought through the risk of it. And I think now they might be confronted with a little bit more of like, what happens if we do.
You mean here in the United States?
Here in the United States, right. So now when they see what's happening with the stock market and such, you know, it'll be a little clearer what would happen here as well.
I think there's a scenario where you can imagine this is good for Hillary Clinton. I mean,
that's what I'm saying. I think it
good
could
that
be
they
too.
Took the risk, and we can. It's like watching somebody putt first, and you see how it breaks.
Right, exactly.
It depends on how this, you know, rolls out, though, because I mean, this was a country also that when I think this vote shows that when you fear for your public safety, which is the number one role of government, is to keep you safe. I think the Brussels and Paris attacks had a great deal to do with this vote. They feel very nervous. That plays into the Trump theme. So I don't see this as being helpful to Hillary Clinton. I don't know that we're going to see any big volcanic eruptions between now and November anyway overseas.
You know, I was listening to the BBC yesterday while the polls were open, and there's a law there where reporters cannot say anything of politics while the polls are open. It was fascinating.
Wow.
So the things they couldn't talk about, they couldn't talk about turnout. They couldn't talk about any polling and none of that. They could talk about the weather, but only peripherally. And, mm-hmm. you know, the weather was a big part of, you know, you said that concerns for safety was an impact of this. And maybe the weather did, too. They had torrential storms in London. And, you know, the younger people tended to stay home, from what I understand, because of the bad weather.
What I did see, though, in the exit polling data, that younger people tended to support staying much more right. than older people. So that you have all this older population voting to get out, and they're not going to have to live with the consequences nearly as long as these younger voters.
But they remember not being in. That's what's interesting, because usually you think of the younger people voting for a change.
For the rebellion.
The older people are old enough to remember before the European Union, and they wanted to go back to that period.
Well, maybe they don't have 401ks. I mean, I don't understand that. You know, maybe too many of my personal decisions as a guy in his mid-50s, okay, 57, are...
John, do you remember Steve Brine, a former
intern
here?
You're still mid-50s, John. I'm
Thank
going
you.
With it.
Thank you.
Yep. He's not
no.
in his mid-50s.
Yes,
Who's
yes,
Steve
yes.
Brine?
Steve Brine was an intern at WGN Radio from London, from England.
Oh, I do remember him.
He's,
yeah.
Do you know he's a member of Parliament now?
He would be. He was yeah. very ambitious.
So we stay in
good.
Touch. He was very ambitious. We stay in touch. He's a conservative member of Parliament. And so I was looking at some of the details about him. He was a conservative who wanted to stay. And, you know, so he lost. So what does his political career end the way Cameron's does? You know, because it was a real split in the Conservative Party. There's so many things to shake down in this.
It was
go ahead,
sorry,
Kristen.
I was just going to say it was so interesting to listen to David Cameron's speech, because unlike here where somebody might have doubled down, he congratulated the Leave movement. He said the voters have spoken. I think it was a 72% turnout of voters, which is remarkable. So you can't just brush this aside as people didn't know what they were doing. They knew exactly what they're voting for, and this is what they chose. And he's going to step aside.
And he called the vote, right?
He called for the vote.
He didn't have to do it.
He hung his career on it. Actually.
I think you can say that people didn't know what they were doing. I think people don't know much of what they're doing. I mean, look at how many Americans have an opinion about what we should do in Afghanistan and Iraq. We can't find it on a map.
John, there's something going around the internet that at 2 hours after the polls closed, the Google search, what happens if we leave the EU? I'm not kidding you. Went up 250%.
Yeah, well, they're about to find out. You know, I wonder how much of this was influenced by scary memes or super patriotic posts, you know, where you're playing on people's emotions, and you know how social media can mold topics and elections in this country. And I wonder if some of that was going on there, you know. Mm-hmm. And if so, again, what's the takeaway here? Did you see Rex Hupke's piece where he spoke about, I don't know why I'm even thinking about this right now, but where he talked about the belief in this country right now that we need to keep immigrants out because these wave of, you know, Muslims are bringing the terror with them. And Hupke said, but if you look at the facts, terrorism, even today, is still very white and homegrown. It's not the immigrants that are the problem. But if you listen to Donald Trump or read the scary posts on Facebook, you wouldn't believe that. And I wonder if some of that kind of dynamic is what happened in England.
He is correct that in this country, more mass shootings have occurred by white males. But that is not true globally. If you look at all of the mass, what qualifies as a terrorist attack around the world, they are most often connected somehow to radical Islam. And I'm not, this is, go do your own research. But globally, it's not true that it is a white male who got a gun legally who is causing
Do you count like a Jared Lochner, the guy in Aurora? Do you who do you count as a terrorist?
I mean, if you go to, there are a couple sites that track this, and they're nonpartisan. They just list worldwide. So we're talking Pakistan, Indonesia, Bangladesh, places where there have been suicide bombers who are then linked or declare an allegiance to ISIS that don't get the same amount of media attention. I mean, there have been maybe 30 so far this year in 2016 of groups that made it, that attacked. And again, some of these are in Israel, which is under almost daily attack. And I don't know that I would necessarily, connect Palestinians to, unless they are connected to Hamas, directly with, you know, global terrorism and ISIS. But the list is long. I'll just say that.
There was a study that I was looking at, and it said in the United States since 9/11, if a definition of a mass shooting or a terrorism shooting like that is four people or more, we average 19 a year. 19 a year. Isn't that a surprisingly high number? Let's segue to what's going on in Chicago. The city council passed ordinances that favor, I think, Airbnb and Uber services. Some residents and aldermen are worried that these new regulations are complicated and in some instances maybe even contradictory. And more importantly, they worry that this service now is going to disrupt neighborhoods or cab services, at least for the drivers. What do you guys think of the city's attitude or Rahm Emanuel's attitude about these services?
I mean, I think the city council came to it's a little soon to tell because some of the aldermen were complaining that on Uber, for example, they just got the agreement dropped in their laps hours before they were going to vote on it.
Right.
But they really kind of struck agreements where they're going to allow these, you know, innovative companies to continue to operate here and not overregulate them to death, but instill some measure of regulation. So with Uber, with Airbnb, they did strike kind of a middle of the road compromise on both of those issues.
I see them as slightly different. I mean, they're obviously both tech companies, and you know, Uber's the ride hailing app. And it seems to me like we can easily overregulate something like that because, you know, out of tradition or fear. But that when your phone is tracking your trip and the phone in your driver's car is tracking the trip and everybody knows who's in the car with whom, it seems to me that that is such a safeguard. And you just don't see, you know, huge problems around the country with Uber drivers and Lyft drivers. You see some, but you also see problems with taxi drivers. I'm not convinced yet by what I've seen that Uber and Lyft are more dangerous than taxis and that you need these ultra security measures to protect riders in those situations. The Airbnb situation, I look at that. I've stayed at Airbnbs around the country. I think it's a great idea. I don't know how it would feel if one person on my block decided they would have their house be Airbnb, that'd be okay. But then if there's no control, and if you have a developer come in and say, okay, I'm going to take – and you could see that happening in neighborhoods close to the downtown where someone would buy up a condo building and sort of create almost a hotel. And so you need to regulate that because it's not self-regulating in the way that I believe these rideshare companies are. So I see them as different problems. And I really do see that the city has an obligation to make sure that the Airbnb stuff stays under control and stays something that and keeps the original spirit, which is like, hey, I've got this extra property or I'm leaving my house, I want to rent it out. That's okay, but you don't turn it into its own little industry. You know what I'm saying?
No, yeah, I do. And it seemed to me like the accord they struck sort of made sense. If it's a primarily residential neighborhood, the way I understand it, then they're not going to allow it or make it as easy for Airbnb to operate there. But in some of the apartment and condo heavy areas, then that'll be the case. You can petition. If enough people sign, you can kind of change it in your neighborhood. It sounds like you can then get another petition and change the petition of the people that changed it. So it gets complicated. But it seems to me, but I'm with you completely, Eric. I would worry that it's my house. This is where I live. This is where I come home after work. And if there's different people partying next door all the time, then I would expect the city would sort of save me from that.
And they did exactly what you said. But one of the aldermen who I think made the most salient point was, this is a solution in search of a problem. It really has not been a problem. And globally, if you look at the number of people using Airbnb and the number of complaints, it's really, really low. That said, it does make sense for, especially in single family home neighborhoods or even in some of these condos, they are limiting how many can be rented out. They have to pay a fee. There's a petition to reverse it, as you mentioned. So those are reasonable requests.
And I think that we can agree, maybe not, but that that you want these regulations to be in the interest of consumers and residents. You don't want them to be put in place to protect existing industries, both with the cabs and the hotels. That you can't have – you can't say, well, we're going to protect our hotel business by regulating Airbnb. I think that's wrong. I think protecting customers and residents is fine.
Well, but what's wrong with protecting the hotel industry if they're paying the taxes and Airbnb isn't? I mean, I think there's some – equity there, right? I mean, it's not wrong for them to expect Airbnb rooms to pay the taxes.
It's just the new world. I mean, I'd love it if people would protect the newspaper industry because we pay the taxes and we do X, Y, and Z. But it just technology has emerged that is nudging out what is traditionally how people rent rooms in other cities. And I think you have to find a balance there.
We are struck dumb by Kristen's logic.
Right.
Listen for the flush.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Oh, yes.
Oh, he's back.
I've had some technical problems. I heard everything you said, but I was really waxing brilliant, and you guys missed some really good A material for me.
Back up. Let's hear it.
No,
the moment has passed.
Okay, all right.
Let's move on to Kristen McQuarrie's editorial. She wrote about how John Cullerton, the Senate president, went to a parents' meeting in at the John Coonley Elementary Grade School on the north side and sort of got a comeuppance. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, Kristen, but just sort of tell us that story. I think it was fascinating what happened.
So the Senate president, John Cullerton, who's been in Springfield for 37 years, did what lawmakers do. He went to his district. He met in the school library with a bunch of Chicago Public Schools parents to talk about education funding. The parents are frustrated. Their school is facing $1 million in budget cuts. They wanted to know what they could do. And every time they brought up an issue, President Cullerton blamed Rauner, the governor, Bruce Rauner. And it just turned into this, the audience kind of started to transition and started to sort of attack Cullerton because they said he offered no ideas. He had no real answers. They acknowledge, hey, you're the guy who's been in Springfield for 37 years and your Democratic counterpart, Mike Madigan, has been in the House for 45 years. They sort of tried to hold him accountable, and it just got sort of hostile, and Cullerton ended up leaving the meeting and being, pretty upset by what had happened. He at one point reminded all the parents, hey, I volunteered to be here tonight.
I didn't have to be here. Isn't that a stunning? And that's his district, right?
That's his district. These are his constituents. And these are, by some of the parents' measure, I mean, these are Democrat-leaning
what a smug son of a bitch. How do you say that to those people? I'm amazed. He and Madigan should do more of this. More, town hall meeting. Conference.
As much as this went sideways for him, I give him credit for going out and meeting with people. In my column today.
Credit? He's supposed to do this. He should do it every week.
You're right. But as contrasted with Speaker Madigan, who barely emerges from his office, he doesn't meet with the editorial board. I was talking to his guy this week. He said he hasn't come to the Chicago Tribune since they were talking about lights at Wrigley Field.
Wow.
And he's decided ever since then it's not worth his time to meet with the people who disagree with him.
That was, 1987?
Well, he's busy. 88. Yeah.
He's busy.
And I just think, politically and every other way, you just got to meet with people and talk to them and let them pin you to the ground like Cullerton apparently got pinned to the ground.
So is there a budget deal? I mean, the Senate's going to be back on Wednesday. The House...
They're both coming back on Wednesday, and I can't imagine that they would be calling everybody back if there isn't something to vote on.
I mean, Governor Rauner said they were very close, which he said every week for the past eight, I think.
I'm guessing they're going to go with a half-year budget. They all want – I mean, there's a great deal of interest, I think, in postponing this till after the election.
But don't you love the Democrat at that meeting who says, look, I'm a Democrat. He said, I'm as far left as they get. But that guy's been in there for a couple of years, and you too, he was talking to Cullerton and about Madigan, said you've got about 80, 85 years in there. So whose baby is this?
Well, and the other thing, of course, is that a lot of the person whose baby this is, the people whose baby this is, are the Chicago mayors and the school board members and people who have kicked the can down the road as far as the pensions, gotten them into some of the problems they've gotten into. This is not completely a state problem.
I don't know, Eric. I was thinking about their going away speech or their epitaph. I'm sorry, I don't mean to bury these guys, but really, how will history remember those two guys, their tenure for running government in Illinois? And I thought, God, what a hard speech that's going to be to write. I mean, don't you think we'll look back on their tenure sadly, angrily, unfavorably?
I mean, this is a really the more I'm here. I mean, they still are not wearing the jacket for all of these budget problems. Rauner is extremely unpopular.
And John, it's weird. You say that like their tenure is going to end.
No need to start working on that speech right now.
Someday. I don't wish ill on anybody, but at some point history is going to be written about those two guys and what happened over the 50 years that they were running the joint.
84.
And even if they were low-level politicians, it would still be embarrassing to say, the 4 or 5 decades I was there, that's what happened.
Yes, but let's not forget that Republicans have held the governor's mansion for most of the last, 35 years or so, with Thompson and Edgar and Ryan and now Rauner. And they have, I don't blame Rauner for most of this stuff, because all this stuff came before him. He inherited a big steaming pile on his doorstep, no question about it. But there were decisions made by Republican governors, and I think that even our editorial board has certainly acknowledged that Thompson and Edgar in particular and Ryan, they made decisions that contributed to this. Now, the Democrats went along with them, in some cases urged them on, but this is a bipartisan mess. And it's all based, in my view, it's based on this idea that nobody wants to to balance what we bring in revenue with the services that we want to offer. No one's willing to tell taxpayers you got to pay more, and no one's willing to tell taxpayers you got to take a little less from state government. So they want.
Boy, if anybody could, it'd be these guys. I mean, they get reelected no matter what. So
they
if,
do, but they're interested in amassing their power and winning some of these swing districts. That's their issues. Madigan could do anything. He could, like Donald Trump said, he could shoot somebody in the middle of the day in the middle of the street, and he'd be reelected. But he's not worried about his reelection. He's worried about his caucus's reelection.
By the way, that's a very late mention in this podcast for Donald Trump. We just maybe alluded to him earlier, but does anybody have anything to say about Trump this week? Any burning observation or question for the gang about the presidential campaign this week?
Well, he gave his address to criticize Hillary Clinton, which, Clinton has given a couple to lambast Trump, but I think it was PolitiFact or one of the outfits said that 59% of the facts he posited were incorrect.
Sorry,
and she's a world-class liar.
Now, I think her number was 12, which is a little higher than we'd like. But 59 is pretty high.
But it was clearly, reading off the teleprompter and staying disciplined, one of the things that he did, he gave that speech, was it on Tuesday morning? Wednesday morning? Whenever he gave the speech. And he didn't go right out and step on it with some stupid tweet or some off-the-cuff interview where he ruins his own. He maintained radio silence most of the rest of the day.
And it was pretty boring.
What's that? Him.
Don't you think?
But the speech itself, it was a grab bag. It was kind of wild all over the place and mendacious as well. But it did. It was a different kind of political speech than the kind that you were used to from him. And it signaled, I think, a turn in his tone.
I guess my point
is,
you're right, he made the turn, he was more sedate, he read it, and maybe it won't work for him.
And it comes after, of course, firing Lewandowski. So.
And who is now going to be a commentator on CNN. I know CNN has no soul, but now they don't even care. They've hired Corey Lewandowski. And then he appeared on Aaron Burnett's show right afterwards, and she was talking to him about the terms of his going to CNN. And it appears as though, while he's still a great supporter of Donald Trump, he's not even going to say anything bad about Donald Trump. I mean, what if he had an informed opinion and it was negative about something Trump said? But when you leave the Trump campaign, you've signed an agreement that you're not going to disparage him, evidently. I'm so sad to see CNN hire this guy.
Why? How is this different than David Axelrod leaving the Obama campaign and being a commentator on all of the talk shows in much the same way?
Yeah, I don't know.
Well,
is there
an agreement? Does he have like a non-disclosure something with Trump where he can't criticize him?
Evidently, yeah.
Well, that's different. That's a big difference.
We don't know what his disclosure agreement was.
Your Honor,
Trump.
Strike my answer to Bertrand's question. But I still think...
You can have people like Nicole Wallace, who's on MSNBC, who is a former top McCain campaign.
Well, closer than that, Rick Tyler was a communications guy for Ted Cruz until he got chased for making Marco Rubio remarks about the Bible.
Well, they all hire surrogates.
Right? So Tyler, but that was in this campaign, and he is now on with – and he had – in his early days, he was almost just a conduit to the campaign. He was saying whatever the campaign wanted.
I mean, journalists do it all the time. I mean, when we lose someone from the newsroom, 9 times out of 10, they're going to work for a political candidate whom they covered while they were there. I mean, so I think this idea that this is purity is a little far-fetched. You have Al Sharpton, who has made, you know, numerous anti-Semitic remarks, and I mean, he has a gig with MSNBC, and
MSNBC, yeah.
Sure. I mean, so I'm not getting the outrage over Corey Lee. I think it's a good get.
I wouldn't be outraged if he went to Fox, and I'm disappointed what MSNBC does sometimes too. But in my world, CNN was still aiming for the middle, and to me, this is. And I don't even mind them hiring advocates, Eric. But I mean, Lewandowski is. Is he that valuable to the discourse in America? I think that's my point, that you've got to put him on staff.
Well, I don't know about having you pay, whether you need to pay for that kind of opinion or not, but I do like the idea, and I do like what I see on these cable stations where they have people of strongly differing viewpoints exchanging their views, contrasting them so we can hear them, so it's not just one propaganda line after another. So, you know, I think you can aim for the middle and have people on both sides firing at the target.
Yeah, I don't think it's a big deal, John, you're hiring someone who's going to offer you an insight into the campaign. As long as he's going to offer you a genuine insight and not, you know, and that his paycheck from Trump doesn't depend on what he says on CNN.
And I bet he will always be identified as former Trump campaign manager. So you're getting the upfront. You can use your own lens to decide what he says. I mean, that will be part of his bio every time he's introduced.
All right, to hell with you. Let's move on to something else then. Hey, does anybody worry or is everybody happy that Derrick Rose is leaving the Bulls?
Why would you be happy?
Well, because at least now we don't have to worry about that. I mean, you know, the Bulls are turning a corner, and it's without Derrick Rose. They needed to turn a corner. I think the team is better without
him. They've been turning corners with Derrick Rose, my friend.
If you had to keep one, Jimmy Butler or Derrick Rose, who would you keep, Steve?
No, I'd keep Jimmy Butler. I didn't say they were good corners they were turning with Derrick Rose.
No, but I mean, not to plug VibeScore, that little app that I came up with. I'll do a segment on this later on, but the Vibers are very happy to see Derrick Rose go in the Chicago Sports.
They need to start again. John, did you watch any of the finals, the Warriors against the Cavaliers?
Sure, I did.
You watch those teams, you realize how far from being that good the Bulls are.
Yeah.
And you can add little jewels around Rose and Butler, but you have to basically break it down. I think you need to keep Butler. Joakim Noah is going to be gone, right? I think you really have to start again, and they're going to start again. They're rebuilding now.
And
Go ahead.
I'm not a big NBA fan, but I just see it more as the human story, and it's a sad story.
Oh, you know, it is.
It's a Chicago kid who had Chicago on his shoulders, and it looked like there was going to be so much promise, and it just ends sadly. That's the way I see it. So,
well, you could describe the physical story that way, but it's also sort of the personal story of somebody who's personality wasn't ready for the success that he achieved, and I think he got some bad advice along the way. And so that whole narrative of Derrick Rose, where we love him and he's the comeback kid, and God, he made great Nike commercials, and we just so were there for him. But our opinion in time changed, and I think people are like, sorry it didn't work out, dude, but good riddance. I hope good things happen to you at the Knicks, but we don't want or especially need you anymore.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't great with the media, but he wasn't a disaster either. I mean, there are any number of people who have handled the kind of fame and money that he got far worse than he did. I mean, I think he did okay. He's got a lot of money. He's going to New York. He's got a fresh start there.
Yeah. I hope they do well. I hope he does great. I mean, he sure has the talent. It would be a shame to see it not realized. Our recommendations for the week go like this. At the end of this podcast, we ask the gang to recommend something they are watching, reading, listening to, or drinking. Anybody want to jump in here first?
What's
the recommendation?
I'll go with one. There's a blogger, Will DeFries, I think is how you say his name. And it's the blog post is called "This Hipster Marriage Announcement from the New York Times is the Most Insufferable Yet." And what he does is, you know, the New York Times has these marriage announcements that are really like long and detailed.
Yeah.
And he was doing line by line. He analyzes this in increasing frustration. It says here, this is a quote from the article itself. When asked for words to describe himself and his friends, the groom replied, "You could try heady. On the one hand, we are people who enjoy lots of books and investigating particular questions having to do with the human existence or God or the nature of beauty. but at least three of us are capable of cooking dinner to Taylor Swift and enjoying that too.
And that's in the wedding.
I just want you to read it to me.
The commentary says he simply means that his friends have pretentiously intellectual conversations before dancing in the kitchen.
If the bride reads that, does she still want to be married to that
guy? The bride is just as loathsome as the groom. You have to read this. My dad sent it to me, and I just was laughing out loud in my office. It's really great. Put a link up on our Mincing Rascals page.
Yeah, well, the link is here. How about you, Steve Bertrand? What do you like this week?
I have whiffed all week.
I'm week long.
Leaving for Prague in less than a week and Vienna. So I like to look, I feel like responsible to learn about the places and, you know, have so that I know what I'm going to see. So I started reading The Unbearable Lightness of Being and I couldn't get into it. I tried to watch Before Sunrise, right? Remember that movie set in Vienna?
Boy, talk about a pretentious intellectual.
Yes. No,
what is he saying?
He's saying he tried.
He puts on Taylor Swift and he dances.
Come on. And so last night, my exciting Thursday night, I was at home alone watching Amadeus.
Oh, my God, no.
And it turns out it was all shot inside.
Why are you sharing this, Steve? This is not attractive
because,
at all.
Because I whiffed. I whiffed this week.
He was in tube socks with a big bucket of chicken on his lap while he watched it, right?
That's right.
I hope so. Kristen, what do you like?
So this is old.
By the way, what was the recommendation then, Steve? So you have nothing for us?
That's what I'm saying. That's what whiffed means in my world.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead,
have
Kristen.
You guys seen the kid? I think he's from Arlington Heights who does all the impressions. Yeah. If you haven't seen him do his Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders impression, he was on The Tonight Show this week. It's absolutely fantastic. Just Google kid impressions and you'll see it.
This morning on Morning Joe on MSNBC, they played that with Bernie Sanders sitting on set.
Oh,
great. So they had a split screen of Sanders. It was just so sweet.
Did he laugh?
Oh, he laughed. It just was great, yeah.
And the kid does a really good Hillary, too.
He does.
I mean, he really has range. My recommendation this week, I think I've just said this before, but O.J. Made in America, the ABC, ESPN 30 for 30 film. I'm 4 hours into it. It runs 7:43. It's four parts. We finished episode two last night. It's as good as you've heard, at least so far.
It's just I have a friend of mine pushing it on me. It's so long.
I've heard
incredibly good things about it. My question is, I didn't start watching it yet. Can you go back and start? Is it anywhere?
Yeah.
Is it
on
streaming
demand
somewhere?
And they're running
somewhere?
It all the time. Yeah.
Okay.
They're making it really available on many of their platforms.
Okay. I'll look for that because I really do want to. I've heard that it's really terrific. So
I don't want to watch a story about OJ, who done it, and all that. This is more about Southern California, race in America, the OJ story. It's so much more than about the murder, and it's fascinating. It's
he was supposed
to
be like a post-racial figure, right? That was what he was before he became just a psychopathic killer, right?
Totally. They spend a lot of time talking about the Hertz commercial. Remember O.J. running through the airports and them saying, "Go, O.J., go." And they talked about how here's a black man selling rental cars to corporate America and how different that was. And they reminded us. They show you the commercial over and over again. Everybody cheering O.J. running through the airport is white. There's no people of color. It's sort of this endorsement, the little old lady, the little Girl Scout troop, the woman behind the counter, all versions of white America saying, "Go, OJ, go." And on a subliminal level, it's like, it's okay to root for this black man. And of course, he was a very popular black man who was more comfortable around white America than black. Fascinating if you have 7 hours and 43 minutes to watch it. And that's this week's Mincing Rascals. I'm John Williams. Thank you, Steve Bertrand and Eric Zorn and Kristen McQuarrie. Our podcast is produced by Kristen Decker and our engineer is Bob Ferguson. We'll drop another pod on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store or wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. You can also listen online on the WGN Plus app or WGNplus.com. The Mincing Rascals podcast is a presentation of the WGN Plus podcast network. You can also catch highlights every Saturday from 1:30 to 2 p.m. on the John Williams Show on WGN Radio.